My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking with Bernard-Henri Lévy.
Yes.
Is that good?
Absolutely, my dear.
What can I call you, Bernard?
You can call me Bernard, Bernard-Henri,
okay.
As you wish.
Okay, probably Bernard, because the fewer syllables I have to mangle, the better it is, you know?
Perfect.
Okay, the title of your book is American Vertigo, and it's published by Random House, and this is Alexis de Tocqueville. What was it, the 1840s when he was in this country?
1831.
1831.
Yeah.
And Tocqueville is one of those people who is often quoted but seldom read. I myself have not read Alexis de Tocqueville's Travels in America. And as a practicing pseudo-intellectual, this is a black mark on my record. You understand that I have not read Tocqueville. But everybody seems to know what he did. He came to this country and he looked at us in an open, kind of detached way and made predictions about or observations about the American people that seemed to have some value. Can you talk about that a little bit?
No, first of all, he came with a very special commission, a very special task, which was to investigate in the prison system of America. What about your prison system, your punishment system? This was a starting point. From there, of course, he went all over America. America of this time, it was, of course, much more little than today, 17 states. And investigated in the rest, political system, but also customs, mores, habits, all what those, as the ancient Greeks said, the regime of America. And he made some prediction about the spreading of democracy, about the backlashes of democracy, about the fight between liberty, freedom, and equality in democracy, and so on and so on. So as for myself, 173 years after, with the commission of a big American magazine and venerable, the Atlantic Monthly, the idea was to redo that, was to have to try to get a state of affairs of American of the situation of the American democracy today, the crisis, the deep crisis, and the workings, still sane, still vibrant, still vivid or not. This is what was my own commission.
Why you, though? Well, why were you uniquely qualified to do this?
I don't know. it's really a good question. I cannot know. And by the way, it is a question I asked to the senior editor of Atlantic Monthly. Why me? He answered, because you. I said, but yes, but why? Because.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's okay. No, the point is that, to be serious, I had just published my book about Daniel Pearl, who killed Daniel Pearl, which was already a book about America of some sort, you know, like an American man dead and beheaded in such tragic conditions. So maybe they felt that that I was... I believe that the idea that I was, it was that I might be close enough and far enough to be not the worst guy. Close enough because I love this country, because I am fond of it since a long, long time, and distant because I am a leftist, I am a progressive, and I don't endorse, far from it, the whole policy which is going on today under this current administration. So this combination of criticism and proximity, this combination of strong disavowal of many things which happened there, but from the point of view of a real and deep friendship, they found it was the good one.
The book takes the form, I would say, of an impressionistic view of the country. That is, it's little vignettes,
yeah,
in different cities in America, in different locations. I notice, you took Tocqueville's charge. And you also went to prisons to investigate,
yeah,
some prisons.
Course, of course.
But I think you were in as many nude dancing bars as you were prisons, no? It seems that way from the book, anyway. You have several scenes set in the... I'm not making a moral judgment here. I found it curious that you were in as many lap dancing bars as you were prisons.
Many? No. I went in one. One. No, no. One.
Just one? There's two mentioned in the book.
Because maybe you dreamt. You dream beyond. You dream beyond my book.
Okay.
But you should not, because...
I've never been in one of those places.
You should go.
I have been.
And you would discover that it is not sexy at all.
No, it's not.
It's really sex at the time of Puritanism.
Uh-huh.
It's exactly sex at the time of Puritanism. Las Vegas... really, I don't even know how you can react and erect in such circumstances. It is, all the girls are the same. It's a sort of mechanical, robotic sexuality. It's absolutely stupid. What I did also is to go to a brothel, a bordello. Mm-hmm. That is maybe why you mixed up. I went to a bordello also because... for me, the wave of Puritanism which is spreading on America is a real topic. And you see it, the wave of Puritanism which you saw for the Woody Allen affair, mm-hmm. for the Lewinsky-Clinton affair, there is something very strange in this country. Read Philip Roth, La Tache, The Stain. There is a wave of Puritanism. So I want to study that, if I dare say, in laboratory. Bordello in Nevada is a good laboratory to see how Puritanism works. You will see the scenery, the vignette is rather funny. The prostitute, the girl, has an American flag on her right, a Bible on her left, a price list like in a restaurant for all the prestations, a camera in the roof in order that to be sure that no inappropriate behavior is tolerated. She is unionized, and she has, like in the hospital, you know, the temperature sheet. Mm-hmm. She has, like, at the end of her bed, she has a sheet with all the medical visits every week to be sure that she...
Like elevator inspections. Inspected in February.
Exactly. Inspected February 12, inspected February 19. If you have the 18, you say maybe there is a problem between the 12. But, you know, it's... you have not, frankly, the sense of sin when you are sins or transgression. I was myself nourished by Marquis de Sade, by Georges Bataille, all these writers of the transgression, and you have also in America Henry Miller and so on.
Yes. Who was in France when he did most of his writing.
But he was American. And when you take Nexus, Plexus, and so on, when you arrive in a bordello of Nevada today in America, you really feel depressed.
Well, it's corporate, you know. Everything is corporate.
That's everything is corporate. Everything is healthy. And everything is Puritan.
Listen, I don't normally do this, but I feel compelled to do it in your case because I read the Sunday New York Times book review written by Garrison Keillor. And I thought he unfairly... He really hated your book. I know he's a critic and he's entitled to his opinion. But I thought that his criticism was unfair. I thought that, and I'm not trying to butter you up here, this is strictly a case of being savaged by somebody who it seems barely read your book.
I don't want to comment on that, you know.
Okay.
No, I tell you why. No, not I can comment, of course, but for me, reviews are reviews. I never react. It is the rule of the game. It is the rule of the game. And it is even more the rule of the game because I decided to publish this book in America first. It is the first time I believe that a French writer decides to publish a book written in French in America before his own country.
Mm-hmm.
So I take my risk. I address it to American audience. American audience react. You, Ed, like it. He, Garrison Keillor, does not like it. He wants to become a killer, to kill. That's the game. It's okay.
Yeah.
No point. No point.
Okay. But
The only thing I did, mm-hmm. I sent a letter to Sam Tannenhaus, to the publisher of the book review. I just said in my letter to the editor that I would be glad to spend 1 hour in front of a public and in front of Mr. Keillor and to discuss face to face, not like in Western. You know, I'm not playing OK Corral. Nevertheless, I like duels. But verbal, I'm a Frenchman, you know,
yeah,
in France, when you
Sartre
are...
Sartre lives in you, eh?
Yeah. I would like to argue with him to see exactly what is the weight of his arguments and to have a chance to answer, but in front of an audience.
No,
we'll see if he reacts. Why
not? Well, you don't know yet. He's
no, the my letter will be run... probably
next Sunday.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
usually
no,
a two-week
in, in 2 Sundays.
In 2 Sundays, right. Okay.
In 2 Sundays.
Well, the only reason I bring it up at all is because if anybody read the review, they would not have an idea of what your book is about.
I know.
That's that's the only reason I brought that whole thing up. I noticed reading your book, you make a lot of film references. Now, I do movie reviews here, and of course, I make a lot of film references in my life. Somebody will always say, oh, God, he's going to talk about a movie again. American films seem to have a fascination for you. Can you talk about that a little bit?
More than a fascination. I was really, as an intellectual, as a writer, I was shaped by three things. American writers, American movies, American music. These are the three threads which intricate themselves in my mind and which make me what I am.
So are you a Frenchman then?
Nevertheless, I still am sort of a Frenchman, but an odd Frenchman.
Yes.
I am the Frenchman who likes America, the Frenchman who loves America. Not so frequent. No, I'm joking.
You know, my meager experience in France, I have had no... there's never been... I love the French. The French have always been very nice. I've been in Pigalle, which is not the nicest place in Paris, and everybody was polite. I mean, I never saw this problem that people have with the French. What is that all about?
You have an anti-Americanism in France, nevertheless.
You have an anti-Americanism here.
It's not the same. No, here you have an opposition to the administration, which is different. Myself, I feel really aggressed by the policy of the current administration. I feel really aggressed. And I think that the reaction of the American population is so weak, is so shy in front of this strange and shameful sometimes administration. So this is not anti-Americanism. This is a critique. Legitimate critique of an administration who does a bad task on many topics, you know, to reinforce the military budget and to make new cuts in the healthcare, in the social. This is really bullshit, you know. You cannot accept that. But anti-Americanism is something else. Anti-Americanism is the hatred of America as itself. It's the idea that America, even with a good administration, will be still worth being hated. This is anti-Americanism. In France and abroad. And this anti-Americanism belongs to a tradition in France which is not the left tradition, which is the rightist tradition, the rightist one.
Yes, yes.
The old French fascist Charles Maurras.
People like that.
Jean-Marie Le Pen, from Maurras to Le Pen, yes, because for them, America, this strange country with Jews, blacks, Hindus, and so on, without real common soil, without real common shared ethnicity, is exactly the sort of nation which they hate.
It's interesting that the current administration, the Bush administration, reminds me of nothing so much as the Gaullist administration, because Gaulle thought he wrapped himself in the French flag and said, "I am the Republic," and if you criticize me, you criticize La Belle France. And it seems to me that both Nixon and Bush, who are very similar in many ways, have done the same thing. They've created criticism against me as criticism against the motherland.
It's a game. They all do that. They all say that, but people have stopped to believe that. I met so many people during this journey in America. I went in every single state of this country. I visited every single state.
You didn't visit Portland. You went right by. You went from Seattle to San Francisco,
yes.
Right?
No. I was in Oregon, but I did not write. I visited Portland, but I did not write about Portland itself. That is true.
We're much cooler than Seattle. And you love Seattle.
I love Seattle. I love Portland also. I met so many people, hundreds maybe of people. Really, they don't believe in this story of being against Bush is being against their own country. The contrary. Mm-hmm. To be a real patriot in America today, to be a real patriot means being against Bush. I really believe that. To be a real patriot will be even to... I will not say that because you will cut it at the edition. Yeah. I will not say that.
Let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Bernard-Henri Lévy, and the title of his book is American Vertigo. It's published by Random House. Everybody reads this book. Every American who reads this book is at some point going to say, well, he got this wrong, because this is your impressions of America filtered through your own consciousness, and they will disagree with something in the book, which is not bad, right? I mean, that's what it's all about. One of the very first stories in the book is about the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And I've been there as a baseball fan. And at one time, baseball was the national pastime. Mm-hmm. That's long since gone. I mean, it's been replaced by football and, mm-hmm. and basketball. And basketball also has mm-hmm. Intonations of racial pride on, from African Americans. But you also you tie that in with what you call the museuming of America, yeah. that we tend to preserve things in a way that you find strange.
Kitschy.
Well, you know, one man's kitsch is another man's glory, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. It's just that when you go to a place like Jamestown and everybody walks around in 18th century garb and pretends to make horseshoes and pretends to, you know, to make candles. Is that kitschy, or is that just trying to? You know, we've been accused of having gone from barbarism to decadence without having a golden age. Mm-hmm. Aren't we just trying to preserve what little is left of our heritage? Is that a complicated question?
Maybe it is that, but I think that you do it sometimes well. When you have the Smithsonian Museum for the Indians in Washington, that is great. Mm-hmm. When you have the best collection of art in the world, that is great. You have the best libraries in the world, which is great. You have the libraries of the past presidencies, no equivalent ever in the world. But when you have the Museum of the Corn, when you have you have a museum of petrified stones which are false, a little museum in South Dakota celebrating a fancy cowboy story and so on, I think that it reveals a taste for what Friedrich Nietzsche called antiquarian history, antiquaire, l'histoire antiquaire, mm-hmm. which is not worth of the great history of America. You are a great country with a great past, with great values, with great presidents in your past. It is not necessary to transform every little piece of your past into a museum. It takes some extreme forms. I tell a story when I am in Des Moines, Iowa. I take my room of my hotel room, and in the hotel there is a plate with a cellophane paper and inside some cheese, some false cheese. Some cheese in platter, you know, in a, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I ask, what is that? And they told me it is a reproduction and the eternization and the museification of the plate of cheese which John Kerry is going to eat in this very room next week. It was already in a museum. And you had also above the bed, under a little glass, the letter of the secretary of John Kerry asking the precise composition of his minibar. Regular Dorito, Mars chocolate bar, Diet Coke in can. That was a letter. It was already like a Andy Warhol picture or a Cezanne picture under a glass as a piece of museum. When you see that, you feel that something is getting a little crazy in this way of building memory out of anything.
Well, I think there's one thing you fail to understand about the United States that...
Oh, many more than
well, one. Well, but this specifically with this. We are a very, very large country.
Yeah.
There are great distances between places, and people like to drive. Mm. If you're driving with three kids in the car and they're going nuts, it's good to stop at the world's largest ball of twine, mm-hmm. and spend 15, 20 minutes outside the car walking around this museum of string.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So in South Dakota, if there's a cowboy museum in South Dakota, it's something to keep the kids from making you crazy.
Okay, but what about the cheese plate of John Kerry and the regular Dorito on the minibar? Is that for the kids?
I admit that goes over the line.
Nothing to do with the long road, my dear.
We're in kitsch territory there for sure.
We are in kitsch territory, exactly.
I really have to bring this up because you talk to a couple of the neocons, the neoconservatives. Mm-hmm. You talk to Richard Perle. You talk to Bill Kristol. Mm-hmm. And
Christopher Hitchens.
And Christopher Hitchens, who's started here and went there. Mm-hmm. And I think, in a way, you treated them more fairly than you did a guy named David Brock.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Yes. Now, let me tell you why I think you missed the boat on that one, okay?
Okay.
If I may.
Okay.
David Brock was an assassin, a hired assassin, with words, of course, mm-hmm. for the Republican right. He's the one that savaged Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas hearings. He has written horrible, egregious lies about people. He was Goebbels for the Republican right. One day he woke up, looked in the mirror, and said, "I can't do this anymore." And he said, "I've been whoring myself for the right wing for too long, and I'm going to come clean with it." He wrote a book where he explained all this. It's called "Blinded by the Right," where he tells people what he did and why he regrets it.
I know.
So why is he a bad guy?
He's a bad guy because he's a faussaire, he's a forger, he's a liar.
Yeah, well, he was. You don't believe in redemption? I mean, the man has tried to redeem himself.
I believe in redemption, no problem. I believe in redemption. The man has changed, but he did a real dirty job. It is not journalism. He presented as truth some pieces which he knew were liars. Mm-hmm. And that is, he said in the Esquire paper which he wrote after Esquire interview, that he wanted to shoot President Clinton in between the two eyes. He said it himself. What can I say? A journalist, a man who pretends to be a journalist and whose secret agenda is to kill one of your good presidents with a ball into the bullet into the two eyes. I cannot like him. I cannot like him. On the other side, the neocons, of course I treat them fairly because it's something else. They are wrong. They are wrong on the war in Iraq. They are wrong. I disagree with them on most of their domestic agenda. Death penalty, abortion, gay marriage, on all that. I disagree totally. But I must say that their general conception of their foreign policy, even if you disagree, there is a certain nobility. There is a certain way of making politics with ideas, reintroducing ethics in politics, which is not insane, which is not méprisable. You can discuss that between intellectuals. That is what I do. With Hitchens in Pittsburgh, I discuss intellectual in front of another intellectual. It's fair.
Yeah, but you know they dismiss everything you say. I mean, it's not as though they're listening with an open ear. They'll let you sit there and talk, and their eyes won't glaze over. But they dismiss everything you say as nonsense. And they're coffin salesmen. That's really what they are.
They dismiss. I don't dismiss. I don't. I answer to dismiss by dialogue and by attempt to understand. Moreover, I'm not American, I'm French. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have all over this book a candid eye, not a polemic, you know. There are some subjects on which I'm obliged to polemic. Death penalty, for me, is a scandal. On this point, I have to stand on my point. I say, you American people, and the American left, I said it to many grand names of the left, you should raise the voice against the death penalty. You pretend that American population is not ready for abolition. You don't know. We also said that us in France 25 years ago. I remember François Mitterrand telling me, you know, France is not ready to abolish death penalty. He was courageous. He stood with his point and he gained. He gained the electoral victory and he gained the abolition of the death penalty. So
no more guillotine in France, eh?
I'm sorry?
No more guillotine in France?
Of course not. Oh. Of course not.
See, that's too bad, I guess, in a way.
Of course not.
The guillotine was the most romantic way to go, well.
No, my dear, don't say that. It is a nightmare of France. Since the French Revolution till Giscard d'Estaing, it's images of nightmare.
One more thing about the neocons that I have to, point that I feel like I have to make is that they are what we call chicken hawks. You know what a chicken hawk is
in this
country? Well, there is a bird called a chicken hawk.
Okay.
But in this sense, we mean somebody who will fight to the last drop of somebody else's blood. These are people who all had the opportunity to enlist in the army during the Vietnam War, to fight for the very things that they're yelling about now, and all of them took deferments. All of them had other agendas. This includes Dick Cheney, by the way, who had five deferments during the Vietnam era.
Dick Cheney, for me, is not a neocon. He's not a neocon. He's an old Jacksonian politic. It's something else. Donald Rumsfeld is not a neocon. Donald Rumsfeld is a Jeffersonian. Condoleezza Rice is a Hamiltonian. Something else again. Neocon is something else. Hitchens is a neocon. Bill Kristol is a neocon.
Perlin Wolfowitz.
Wolfowitz is a neocon, yes. Yeah. These are the guys with whom I had pleasure to discuss and to exchange ideas. Maybe they dismiss me. It's possible. Mm-hmm. But I don't.
Okay. This leads me to another question that I was thinking about is, you talk about Jeffersonians and Hamiltonians. Most Americans don't conceive of their politics in that historical kind of a sense. I got the feeling sometimes you were overthinking. Do you know what I mean by the phrase overthinking?
Maybe. Yeah, of course.
I mean, you know, like everything was overanalyzed, and sometimes stuff is just what it is.
That is the weakness and maybe the interest of a foreign eye. A foreign eye sees the same things in a different light. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is not good to see the same things in a different eye. If I tell you, there is a chapter in the book where I make ideological distinctions, for example, between Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. I don't know. Maybe I overanalyze, but maybe there is a part of truth. I try to analyze the evolution of George Bush. I think that you had three steps in the position of George Bush on foreign policy. First step, he was a Jeffersonian. He thought that America has nothing to do in the world, just to be behind the borders and not a dog in any fight all over the world. He was against, for example, Clinton intervening in Bosnia. He said that nation building was bullshit, nothing to do with that. This was the old Jeffersonian isolationist position. Then, second step, after September 11, George W. Bush moved and he became Jacksonian. Jacksonian is something else. It is, we are hit, we hit in order to punish, and we come back at home immediately. Like in Guns We Trust, mm-hmm. Western. You hit me, I hit you, and I come back with a smoking gun. Jacksonian policy. And then he had an evolution to a third position, which is sort of Wilsonian position. Not only hit and run back, but try to, so as they say, spread democracy, make nation building, and which they do, by the way, very badly. They are unable to do that. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to see these three steps of George W. Bush. It is not the same policy. If you want to fight him, which I think you have, you are right to fight him, you have to know the adversary. It is not the same Bush today as the Bush of his first campaign. It is not the same Bush. You have to know that. It's my impression. It's my impression.
Yeah, this is fascinating, but we have to come to an end because we're out of time. I've been speaking with Bernard-Henri Lévy, L-E-V-Y. American Vertigo is the title of his book, and it's published by Random House. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And visit us again.
Okay, thank you, my dear Ed. Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's almost time for KABU's spring membership drive. If you're able to give a gift of at least $500, consider doubling your money by sponsoring a matching challenge pledge during the drive. You can offer to match every gift during the show of your choice up to the amount you choose. This is a great way to motivate others so we can reach our goal and wrap up the drive early. If you're interested, please contact KABU's membership coordinator. You can email membership@kabu.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. You're listening to KABU Community Radio, 90.7 FM. It's 9:31. Still to come on the radio zine at 10 o'clock, Per Fogering interviews filmmaker Mark Manning about his documentary, Caught in the Crossfire, The Untold Story of Fallujah. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher hosts an interview with members of Oregon Children's Theater's production of The Giver.